I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Stefan Eich, assistant professor of government at Georgetown University. We're discussing his recent book, The Currency of Politics, from Princeton University Press, which recently won the ABCEF Foundation's Best First Book Prize. His research is in the history of political thought, especially the political theory of money and the politics of financial capitalism, and he has published several articles on these topics. Okay, well, first of all, Stefan Eich, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Stefan, I love this book. It's a great sweeping history of the political theory of money, I think. Great sort of conceptual clarity when thinking through these issues, and very quite interesting readings of the different theorists that you take up. So congratulations on the book, first of all.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, what was the motivation for writing the book in the first place?
I think it was, as always, a deep intellectual crisis. So this is a book that, you know, has a long autobiographic tale in some way of having been very enchanted with monetary economics as an undergrad and really looked at money from the perspective of economists, and then lost faith in that whole way of looking at it, went into intellectual history, German philosophy, critical theory, post-Kantian philosophy, and returning very gradually back to some of these questions after many years and trying to find a voice to look at them again, partially to kind of make them visible to political theorists, but also partially to kind of work through my own trauma of what I saw or didn't see when I first looked at money. I could expand on this, but it has to do with, in some way, what you see and what you don't see, and which took me a long time to actually appreciate.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, maybe we could start with a kind of big question. It is the history of political thought of money, a book that you've written. Maybe you could kind of we could talk about some of the big picture issues before we delve into the political theorists, particular theorists that you discuss. Maybe you could talk about sort of, I guess, the general question about what is money, and how, in general, the kind of function that it serves, and the kind of central, debate, I think, that surrounds this issue in political theory, at least as you develop it, which is the kind of how much to politicize the role of money in political community.
Yeah, I should first of all say that I first tried to get as far away as I could from that opening question of what is money, because it seemed to me that so much of the existing literature on money by economic historians, by economic sociologists, and so on, had gotten a little too focused on these kind of ontological questions, kind of what is money, when was money created? And what seemed to have gotten lost were the debates about, you know, the political significance and ambivalence of that institution, the way it continued to evolve in a way that was really not reducible to one single static entity of, you know, money as it was created once and then existed. And so actually, I think in the first version of the manuscript, I flat out refused to tell people what is money, which I was not able to get away with. So I did have to put my cards on the table. But just to kind of preface this by saying that the attempt was to shift some of the focus away from ontological question of what is money towards historicization of different debates of people thinking about what to do with money and how money would actually change in the process of different forms of monetary acknowledges developing, the way in which money's meaning changed radically depending on the political context in which it was embedded, and to kind of bring it alive as something that was not static but in motion, constantly debated, with people having very radical different vision of what money could be, which again, like, it seemed to me to be impoverished if we just focus on the what is money. So having gotten that out of the way, the conception of money that I found most persuasive and which kind of tacitly structures the book is the position which, I mean, used to be a revisionist. I think by now it's in some way the new dominant view, but it's the idea of money as a form of a credit system, essentially, So rejecting the old tale of economics textbooks of, you go move from barter to coins towards, more modern forms of money, and eventually you end with credit money. And instead to follow the literature and anthropology and economic sociology of the last really 20, 30 years to begin with credit and to kind of appreciate the way in which money is never really about the kind of token, the material object, but instead about the kind of system of collective beliefs about, promising things about the future, engaging in credit and debt relationships and structuring them. So that's really what I take to be at the heart of my conception of money. That also immediately tells you why I find it very futile to look for the origin of this. I don't think you'll ever be able to find like an instance as clean cut as, let's say, the first coined object or so, if you adopt that more credit-based theory of money. But it does push things back significantly, and it detaches it from the material object often used to symbolize kind of a monetary token, and towards kind of more abstract ideas that maybe are more familiar to political theorists about the way in which legal systems operate, right? So it's much more closely associated with ways in which we account for different relationships, in which we think about the future, in which we record obligations and duties. That's much more the kind of origin of money I would focus on.
Right. There's a, I mean, you emphasize the sort of temporal aspect to money, which is quite interesting, that it has an abstract character and it's connected with belief, but it's also connected with promises to the future and a kind of connection to the past. I don't know if you want to speak to that kind of in general and how, that in itself, I mean, is a kind of way in which money is part of a community, and so far communities are involve a kind of past, present and future.
Yeah, I mean, in a narrow sense, this temporal dimension is really, constitutive of much of the thinking about money in the Western tradition of political thought. It's already the way in which Aristotle describes money essentially as solving a temporal problem of consumption over time. And I think if you follow the credit-based views of money, that just becomes even more pronounced, right? Like credit is essentially a promise that extends over time, right? You promise to do something in the future. And if that's your entry point into questions of money, really becomes very quickly about intertemporal systems that tie different people together in one form or another. And that has, profound implications of a distributive kind, of questions of trust and violence, like whose promise do you trust, and so on. But also a way in which it makes visible a view of societies as embedded in time, like, as kind of having a certain understanding of their own past that matters for questions of trust, belief, faith, and a temporal extension, which again is something I would want to historicize. So this is like, in emphasizing the temporal aspect, one shouldn't adopt a view of this as too static. But one of the things I found interesting was to simultaneously historicize different monetary technologies and different conceptions of the future, different ways of, thinking through that temporal dimension. And it changes dramatically as you kind of move through the centuries, as you move towards conceptions of public debt and so on. So that's part of what interests me. That seemed a good way to capture some of the more profound changes in the way in which societies relate to money, and in turn, the ways in which societies seem to be shaped by different monetary technologies and monetary imaginations.
The other thing that occurred to me in thinking about money and kind of this more abstract credit term is, I wonder if you've sort of, I don't think this is totally present in your book, so apologies for asking something that's not in your book, but I wonder what the if there's a connection between the money and what you could call the sacred versus the profane. That is, the way in which money tends to be connected with the profane as opposed to the sacred, but strikes me that that's not a necessary connection. I mean, somewhat of a contingent connection that, money. I mean, you talk a little bit about coinage in the book, and sometimes this has a kind of the Athenians had Athena on one of the coins and whatnot. So, is there? I mean, is there some? I mean, what are your thoughts in terms of the connection between money and the sort of aspiration of human beings for the divine or elements of the sacred, which tend to characterize communities versus, you know, the kind of profane elements that characterize our material lives.
Yeah, no, you're perfectly right that it's not emphasized as much in the book. Partially, it might be a kind of consequence of really focusing on the legal and linguistic dimension, the way in which societies and political thinkers grapple with the ways in which different monetary institutions can be adapted, can be changed, and can be fitted to, you know, more adequately reflect different societal values. I think what gets a little bit lost in the process is, in some way, the backward-looking part, like the sources of belief and faith. Right? Instead, I focus, I think it's fair to say, more on the kind of forward-looking part of that belief system. But if you look backward, and you know, it becomes, you know, as you say, very clear in the Athenian case, and it's very well documented in the literature, there's an extremely tight link between these conceptions of collective belief and faith, and, you know, religious rituals of sacrifice, you know, embodiments of faith that link value to, you know, questions of theology. And so I don't focus on this that much, but there's a wealth of literature out there making precisely that connection. I got Devon Singh's book, it's very Divine Currency. It's a good reference on this. But yeah, I think if the anthropological literature has done a great job actually highlighting that part in particular.
Good. So you talk about five theorists in particular in the book: Aristotle, Locke, Fichte, Marx, and Keynes. Maybe you could say a little bit about how you picked those five in particular out of many other possibilities.
Yeah, so it was a very gradual process that didn't begin with coming up with like the big names or anything like this, but it was really, as I explain, a process of discovery by traveling through footnotes. So I started basically with Volume 1 of Capital, and followed the footnotes, and, you know, was getting more and more curious and puzzled by the peculiar place that many of these thinkers had in Marx's text. It's kind of there, but only in the margins, removed from the main body of the text. And some names, you know, kept on recurring. And so I kind of moved from there to debates around the Napoleonic Wars and the suspension of specie by the British Empire, like all the paper money experiments of the 1790s, from the French assignat to the British ones, which feature heavily in Marx's writings. And so the names kind of kept on popping up of previous thinkers. So from then on, I ended up with Locke. And so again and again, I found myself in this, you know, quite distressing position of witnessing the project grow much further than I had initially anticipated. At one point, I thought I would be able to write this about a single weekend in 1797. And instead, I ended up with a book that goes from Aristotle to the 21st century. But the underlying theme was to really follow the intertextual links between different authors and different texts that had a peculiar pattern of recurring in moments of crises. So there was a pattern to the way in which the history of political thought about money was written, in the sense that long periods of calm and a kind of relative lack of publication about it, you know, was pierced by these sudden moments of crises in which people not only published their own pamphlets and own interventions, but also returned to previous moments of crises, often republished those texts and embedded references to them in their own writing, in a search for orientation, I think, primarily, a way to kind of justify their own arguments, discredit others, and kind of ground the analysis. And so that meant going backwards and moving from, you know, the French suspension, from the British suspension period and the Napoleonic Wars to Locke. And then from Locke, I very quickly became clear that it was really impossible to tell the story about Locke's intervention without some background of the Aristotelian text that had formed so much of the environment that had shaped, you know, generations and generations of thinkers up to Locke, and had undergone a really interesting, fascinating change in the course of the 17th century. That also tells you that in some way this is not an exclusive list, and it could have very easily added more authors to this on the basis of that same method of intertextuality. There are other texts that are kind of recurring references, but I just had to draw a line somewhere, and, you know, going back to Aristotle seemed as good as anything on that. And then going forward, it also meant that we were still embedded in that same web of textuality, that any debate about money today, like I think, passed through at least two inflection points in the 20th century. One are the interwar debates, where Keynes just has a towering role, I think partially misunderstood and very multifaceted, but a towering role. And obviously the 1970s. So the last chapter of the book is actually in some way the dog that didn't bark. It's about why political theorists kind of came out of the 1970s, having really lost interest in the political theory of money. But that again seemed to me a moment of, you know, intertextual significance that we have to grapple with if we want to relate to these, you know, this layered history that defines the position from which we look at these questions.
Right. And as I understand your thesis, the rough account and the development of history is a kind of, maybe this is simplifying too much, but a kind of pendulum swing between a kind of politicizing money or bringing money onto the public stage as an object of political deliberation and judgment, to a kind of depoliticization of money to kind of remove it from the political process. And that sort of the challenges that accompany both. Is that right? I mean, is that how you think about this?
Yeah, that's right. I would only add that, you know, I only focus on one slice of that entire history. Right? This is in some way the flip side of the intertextualism that I was interested in. And so much of my interest in the history had to do with, in some way, provincializing it, exercising some of the force that it continues to exercise on us. So this is not an attempt to kind of provide a comprehensive history of, you know, all the different strands of thinking about money, and here's like a way to kind of think about them, but in some way trying to grapple with that history that still weighs heavily, most heavily on us today. So I think that's important to preface, because I very much want to invite other people in to write more histories of strands that I didn't cover, and in no way do I mean to be comprehensive. But in the slice that I focused on, I think it's right to say that there were two parallel movements, and which surprised me initially, but it accounts for some of the patterns that I described about the layered quality. And it's in some way a kind of overarching narrative, I think it's fair to say, of money moving further and further away from, you know, political consideration. You know, this is what I describe sometimes as the politics of depoliticization, the way in which at least the appearance of money seems to actually, you know, be relegated further and further away from what we would consider, you know, politics and political thought. And obviously that's most pronounced from the 18th century onwards. But then alongside it, there is a kind of counter narrative of moments of crises in which that perception is, you know, radically collapses, often within a moment of hours or minutes. And there is this sense of a lack of orientation, a search for a new grounding, and an appreciation for the politics part of the politics of depoliticization, the way in which the appearance had in some way misled people into thinking that this was, you know, a problem of natural value or something that economists talked about, rather than a constitutive problem of really how governments, how societies govern themselves and how governments rule. Now, what's interesting about these two narratives is that it seemed to me they were interacting in a peculiar way, in as far as there was a growth in expectations about what could be done in changing money. And so as it's kind of further removing from politics, at the same time, the investment in, you know, radically different monetary systems, the interest in monetary reform only grows. And simultaneously, you know, the kind of disenchantment grows whenever that is tried, or whenever, you know, anything like this is actually attempted. So that adds another twist to the way in which these two narratives interact.
Yeah. So let's talk about Aristotle first. He's the one you start with. As you say, a seminal thinker in this discussion about money. As you point out, he puts sort of money right at the heart of things. It's a crucial tool for justice, as you put it. It's a kind of expression of reciprocity, I was wondering, maybe you could start with a little bit of, because you have a fair bit of historical context on each of these thinkers. I was wondering if you could maybe start with a little bit of historical context around money in, you know, Aristotelian ancient Greece, and then, you know, we can start talking about Aristotle's view and his contribution.
Yeah, this was one of the most fun parts of researching this book, of diving into the economic history, the histories of money, and provide some, you know, context is an overused word, but to actually give a better sense of just the extraordinary changes that had occurred in the background of many of the texts we're reading. And I think it's particularly pronounced in the case of Aristotle's text, maybe because it's so far removed from us, but also because I think it stands earlier the development of this history of coined money in a way that we just take for granted, but I think really has to be brought back into the picture to understand some of the preoccupations, not just in Aristotle, but in kind of classical Greek culture overall. And just kind of, you know, you can ask me to speed up if I deviate too much, but I think it's fair to say, having pushed back the origin of money, you know, to Babylonian accounting systems, let's say, you know, ideas about how taxes are being raised and credit and debt is being tracked, you know, it's fair to say that money existed for at least as long before Aristotle as we are removed from Aristotle, right? So Aristotle doesn't stand at the beginning of money. That's the first interesting thing to kind of reflect on. But he does stand fairly close still to the invention of coined money. And it happened several centuries before he was writing. But I think it's fair to say it was still a relatively new institution that was, for example, absent in much of Homer and the literature of that age, but that emerged after that. And that history of coinage continues to be, you know, heavily disputed along predictable disciplinary lines, depending on, you know, which literatures you read. But it seemed to me important, and I was, you know, really influenced here very early on by reading Moses Finley's just fantastic work that, you know, has received now several layers of revisionism itself, but I think it's still a fantastic starting place. And just pointing out that the purely economic story, like the story of kind of you know, new institutionalism about the emergence of coined money, doesn't fully work on its own, right? So that story essentially emphasizes efficiency. You move from weight, you know, silver or gold, to coined money because it just saves you the effort of having to weigh it every single time, makes transactions more efficient, and so on. You very quickly run into the realization that actually in the ancient Greek world, as it adopted coined money, like many, many Greek city-states adopted their own form of coinage, like to the point that you had hundreds and hundreds of city-states, often very close proximity, issuing their own money and insisting that you primarily couldn't use any other money on the marketplace. So the story of efficiency alone seems to pose like more questions than it solves. It doesn't seem to be entirely efficient to have this, you know, fragmented monetary map of hundreds and different polis issuing their own money. So something else is going on. And Finley, I think, is helpful here in developing this further. And so what I think is fair to say is the literature since then have emphasized more and more the kind of fiduciary premium that came to be attached with individual polis issuing coined money stamped by themselves and attached to the polis in some way or another. So in some way, the coined money, the coined silver, although made out of silver predominantly, didn't trade at the just metal value of silver anymore, but really traded at the face value that different city states, you know, imposed on them. I think that is a first way to begin to think about that institution as not just simply a tool of efficiency, but as somehow tied up with larger questions of trust, faith, collective belief, often tied to the religious symbols of the city, the deities and so on, but also the collective identity of the specific political community that issued it. And I think the anxieties that provokes are still visible in Aristotle.
Yeah, it strikes me that surely, though, that there must have been efforts to resist, you know, the coinage. I mean, on the part of merchants between city states, right? I mean, as soon as you get the efforts on the part of political communities to stamp one particular coin, say, you know, we will not accept Spartan coins in Athens, we will not accept Athenian coins in Sparta, there's got to be some resistance to from that from merchants who just, you know, want to, I don't know, maximize their profit, right? So it makes me think that there's, you know, there's some tension here already, even in the ancient world, between a kind of, you know, the sort of pre-political way of thinking about money, or the more bottom-up approach of how to develop money and its creation and its development, versus the kind of the top-down political stamping of coinage. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yeah, I think the pressure comes from two ways. So long-distance trade continued to be conducted in weight metals very often, you know, definitely outside the Athenian league. And so, yeah, it's not surprising that people probably would have resented the fact that every time they wanted to sell goods and like actually engage in commerce, they would have to, you know, convert things to the local currency. I'm sure there was some resistance. But then, you know, there's also a literature, Leslie Kirk has contributed to this, you know, more than anyone else, emphasizing the domestic opposition on the part of, you know, more kind of aristocratic landowners towards the monetization of the polis, the way in which landowners were forced to essentially, you know, adopt these new monetary tools to pay their contributions, to pay taxes and all this. And, you know, that, so there's a class politics also embedded in this from the inside, not just from the outside, you know, the kind of pre-political trader-based idea. It's from both sides. But rather than kind of dismissing this or kind of marginalizing this, I think for me, this is exactly what defines these political struggles over, you know, who can you trust? What are the institutions that are meant to embody different conceptions of the polity? And you clearly get to a point of having clashing conceptions of what that community could look like, of what value should look like, what, you know, questions of distribution should look like. And money becomes one dimension through which that is very visibly articulated. The fault lines become clear quickly.
Right. So tell us about Aristotle and his intervention then on this.
Yeah, I should say in some way one could read the book just as well, maybe better from the back, right? Like given that it's a kind of excavation that digs through the grounds, there is an argument that maybe the order should have been inverted, but I didn't want to, you know, make it look too much like after virtue. So I stuck with the beginning with Aristotle. But it means that really my point wasn't to recover some kind of Aristotelian ground on which we stand, let alone to kind of suggest a neo-Aristotelian way out of this. But instead, it really is like one layer, fairly low, deep down the mountain that I'm excavating, that continues to define different ways of thinking about money. And so that was really my starting point in emphasizing a deep ambivalence in Aristotle that I think has gotten partially lost, where we're more familiar with one side than with the other. And the ambivalence for me comes from recovering the really substantial hope that Aristotle placed in, you know, money as a tool of reciprocity that would be essential for a well-governed city. And so that's something that strikes one initially as in tension with, you know, Aristotle's well-known critique of wealth accumulation, the reference to Midas, not least in book one. And yet, if you look at, in particular, book five, chapter five of the Nicomachean Ethics, I think there really is a full-blown account of money as a conventional institution that can, under certain circumstances, when used in the right way, namely as a tool rather than an end, really contribute to the way in which a city is held together and can be used as an instrument for you know, expressing political justice and addressing various forms of imbalances. I think that obviously was deeply disappointed, that vision of money as a tool of reciprocity, and can look almost silly, I think, for us. And yet, I think it's important to actually take that seriously and to appreciate the way in which Aristotle thought this could really, you know, under certain conditions and when used in the right way, be aligned with what a just city does. And in fact, a just city might, you know, use money more extensively than we realize. I also think there's a, you know, more complicated paradox whereby he still thought, you know, in the best city, actually in some way, money becomes less and less significant. which leaves you a bit of a bind that already highlights the ambivalence very interestingly, namely that money is this thing that, you know, in the places in which you most need it, is least likely to operate in the way in which you want it to operate. And the places where you least need it, it probably works exactly like you want it to. But that's one side of the ambivalence. And the other side, I think much more familiar to people, is, you know, the worries that are associated with this, the ways in which money is very easily misused and then becomes a source of corruption and confusion, both individually and on the level of the polis. You know, that's still there. I'm not in any way marginalizing this, but it's in the tension between these two simultaneous accounts that I think much of the reception of Aristotle's argument plays out. You know, you really see people running with one way or the other. And part of my attempt of re-embedding this in the historical context was to kind of make both of these sides more visible.
Yeah, I can see the reciprocal character of money. I mean, it's quite interesting. I sense that one minted coin in Athens, it's the same for an aristocrat as it is for a member of the demos, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's equivalent exchange no matter who presents it. It's a common law that governs how it should be exchanged, right? So it's you know, grounding monetary exchange is a kind of norm of equality and reciprocity. So that's interesting. I mean, I wonder. I mean, one other thing that occurred to me in this domain was thinking about how, you know, when we're thinking about reciprocity and money, you know, money has a character of its, you know, it's about the exchange of, you know, essentially material interests. And, you know, you and I enter into a contract because it kind of makes us mutually better off, et cetera. It's kind of standard economic way of thinking about it. But money also has the character of conveying or expressing a kind of honor too, especially in the character of the polis, right? If somebody does something good, they, you know, deserve money, not monetary. You know, if you do a really good job at work, you get a bonus, right? It's not just like a, you know, an exchange, a contractual exchange. It's also an expression of a job well done. I don't know if that's, you know, if that distinction, you know, tracks here in the analysis, either on the, you know, the positive sides of money and its reciprocity and its negatives.
Yeah, actually, I think it is tied to what exactly Aristotle means by reciprocity. So really, in some way, it's a weird modern translation. I think the English word is only coined in like the 16th century, and, you know, comes out of Euclid's kind of mathematical reflections. And so even in Aristotle's text, it's a very kind of tricky, convoluted discussion and trying to differentiate it from, you know, something more like revenge. And so he kind of really runs with a kind of certain Euclidean conception and then embeds it in his idea of political justice. What stands for me at the heart of it is the idea of thinking in analogy, like somehow trying to achieve forms of equality by analogy. So not arithmetic equality, but somehow trying to bring two people in the right kind of relation to one another, which, you know, depending on the context, can be one of arithmetic equality, but it can also one where you want to express the, you know, higher status of honor of one participant. And if you think about reciprocity in that sense, which I think is a little different from the way in which it has come to be used, you know, in economic sociology, or even, you know, law, you know, suddenly you see money as a tool of reciprocity, simply expressing the fact that it's a way to adjudicate the proper relationship between people, you know, to kind of punish transgressions in the negative sense, to kind of make sure that excess and deficit are being addressed in one way or another, right? And that can have a distributive dimension, but it can also entail, you know, celebrating and honoring acts or performances that the city deems valuable, right? So it becomes an adjudicator of value and justice in that context. It's not a coincidence that many of the, you know, awards expressed to Olympian athletes and poets and so on, you know, had this in some way, you know, monetary dimension, and not in a crude way, but precisely to symbolize the honor of this, like the value associated with that. And inversely, it's not a coincidence that this coincides with the city imposing kind of sophisticated systems of fines, of monetary fines, as a way again to assess, you know, kind of damage done and a reimposition of proper value. So it's in that sense of a kind of a mediator, a mean of justice that money appears. Like one way alongside law and speech that people can be placed in a proper relationship to one another.
You know, Aristotle and Plato, for that matter, I mean, the very familiar kind of critiques of oligarchy, certainly more in Plato. I mean, Aristotle at least is willing to sort of incorporate an oligarchy into a mixed regime. But I mean, as you say, that the sort of concerns about money and the corrupting effects on politics is quite present. I you know, I wonder if is there anything, you know, to be said about, you know, does the can the positives of money sort of redress or, if, you know, ameliorate some of the negatives of money? I mean, in the sense that, it, you know, does Aristotle point to a certain way in which, you know, these norms of reciprocity can kind of ameliorate some of the ills that money can be introduced? Or is this just, you know, left up to the kind of statesman to try to emphasize the positives and reduce the negatives?
The first thing to observe is that so much of the critique of oligarchy and money making actually turns out to revolve, if you look more closely, not around money but wealth, which can take a monetary form, very often will take a monetary form, but really doesn't have to be. It can also be in land or, you know, other forms of wealth. That's like one major source of corruption. So rather than simply money being you know, the tool that can be addressed problems, but also the source of all evil, but actually the starting point is a little different. Like there's a long-standing worry about wealth, which predates the introduction of coined money. And it's much, much older, much longer standing. And then there is a more recent institution that I think in Aristotle you can still tell was, I think, sometimes thought to potentially hold, you know, some resources to assess and attack that longer standing problem. You know, the idea being that actually by using money as a tool of redistribution, by using it as a way to impose political justice in the form of fines, in the form of awards, in the form of just assessing the proper distribution of value and determination of excess and deficit, this could be a way to address this longer standing problem of wealth. You know, so that's one layer. Now, on top of that, and Aristotle, again, is great on this, if you look at the Midas part of Book One, like there is at the same time a kind of nascent worry that maybe there is a whole other set of anxieties wrapped up in this kind of the abstraction of money itself, which compounds the worries about wealth, which compounds the worries about oligarchy, in the sense that there is something potentially deceptive about using this, you know, tool in a way that, you know, tricks people into thinking it's an end in itself, you know, which is the constant temptation. I think one part of the Midas section is to suggest such an instance of confusion, of using a means as an end. And I think that's very kind of nascent there. I don't think it's fully developed in Aristotle. Plato might have more to say on this. But I think that's different and distinct from the worry about wealth. Disentangling the two actually adds kind of more complexity to the picture.
I wanted to switch over to Locke, which is a jump of quite a few centuries.
Just a jump, yeah.
So maybe you could say a little bit then now about the sort of updated historical circumstances. I mean, particularly, I mean, we don't have to fill in the gaps between Aristotle and Locke, but Locke was responding to a particular crisis. What is this? The coinage debate, coinage crisis.
Yeah. The coinage crisis or re-coinage crisis. People have different. It gained some notoriety last year when it was revealed that the short-lived British Chancellor of the Exchequer, Kwasi Kwarteng, had written a Cambridge dissertation on the coinage crisis.
Okay, interesting.
He was gone before I think any historians of political thought could respond. but that dissertation is out there.
Okay, well, yeah.
We'll but look first for of all, your... to say
look for your review.
In no way, yeah, in no way I mean to suggest that somehow like nothing happened between Aristotle and Locke. You know, like instead, I was just again struck by the way in which in the early modern debates, like 18th, 19th century debates, Aristotle and Locke were so frequently mentioned together. And so again, this goes back to the intertextuality, but also the way in which there clearly was an account of history and a reading of these texts that had to be provincialized, that had to be contextualized in some way and addressed. Not to foreclose all the kind of incredible monetary thinking that happened in between, but in my hope is in some way to make it more accessible, to make it more visible. Right, really. So the next step should be to look at all these, you know, thinkers in between who were working in, you know, a broadly Aristotelian tradition or challenging an Aristotelian tradition and are nonetheless not part of my narrative. You know, I hope that becomes in some way more visible rather than marginalized. But turning to Locke, it was striking to me that you know, he was really primarily known as a monetary thinker to his contemporaries. Obviously, a philosopher, a physician to some extent, but really the way in which he would have most immediately affected everyone's life and the way in which he gained notoriety in the 1690s is through his influence in the coinage crisis. And so that alone is kind of interesting and worth recovering. And actually, it's something that was very widely accepted and established up until, I would say, like the late 19th century. If you look at kind of editions of Locke's works from the middle of the 19th century, they very prominently print his contributions to the coinage crises, these pamphlets, often ahead of, you know, the two treatises, and really thought that this was the kind of great contribution to statecraft rather than the second treatise or anything like this. And so that is interesting in itself, and reading them closely with an eye towards his larger philosophical picture and the political events of the 1690s, you know, I think helps us to you know, make sense of many of his moves, which I think came to have huge significance afterwards in a way that often distorts what we can actually see. And it takes some effort to actually really recover his political argument. And liberated from his own success, if you so want. The argument was so successful that it obscured itself.
Yeah, good. So you want to walk through, I mean, the Locke's,
yeah, I can...
you know, fifth chapter, the second treatise is one of the most celebrated arguments, and the money section, I think, is sort of very familiar. I mean, what your treatment is quite interesting in thinking through the kind of the depoliticization of Locke's approach, that he indeed lodges money in the contract for money in the state of nature in a pre-political state. So, yeah. So maybe you can talk through that.
Yeah. I mean, this has been long a puzzle, I think, for people familiar with Locke, because you get two different readings of this, and both seem to have some grounding in evidence, and yet they seem to contradict one another. Right? Like, so one reading, as everyone will know from reading that fifth chapter, is that Locke grounds money in fancy or the imagination. Right? It's not something that actually has value by nature, but it's something that's explicitly invented. There's a moment in which it's invented, and then it becomes a kind of, you know, a source for our projecting our fancy and imagination, right? So that places it, you know, in a very familiar, recognizable place, if you look at it from his essay concerning human understanding. But then at the same time, we have readings, you know, really influential readings of Locke on the coinage crises, like, for example, by Joyce Appleby from the 70s, that precisely emphasized the way in which Locke naturalized money. You know, and that seems to be in tension with one another. So, like, money is placed, you know, into the state of nature outside of politics, becomes naturalized. That's Appleby's language. And at the same time, Locke tells us that money does not have value by nature, but by fancy or agreement. So this was in some way the kind of my starting point for the puzzle, and trying to figure out what is going on here. And so what I think I ended up with as a way to frame this and to kind of understand the seeming puzzle is to think about this as a politics of depoliticization. So in some way, a lot of the stuff that Appleby describes is something that happens after Locke. Like, this is the effect of his argument, which had a naturalizing effect. Kind of, it did remove debates about money, you know, from politics and seemed to ground them in nature, to the point that Smith, for example, you know, agrees with Locke's strictures against debasement, but criticizes him for saying, like, you know, he thought it had a grounding in fancy and imagination, but we now understand it actually has value by nature. You know, so in some way, you see the effect of the argument. In Locke itself, you know, you don't find a lot of reference to naturalization, but instead there is a political recognition, what I would call of the politics of trust. So in some way, money is too important politically to leave it to politics. Now, that doesn't mean that you just hand it over to the market, right? It's very important, I think, to insist that Locke doesn't just simply advocate that, you know, the silver coins should be priced according to what the value of silver is in Amsterdam or Hamburg. It's not just simply adopting the market value, but instead he insists on essentially returning to a previous political promise, like the old rate, the old Elizabethan rate, which had been degraded through various forms of coin clipping and, you know, forgeries and so on, like acts in which coins were essentially, you know, clipped on the edges, and the silver thereby gained was melted up and sold, and the coin continued to circulate at the old nominal value, to the point that, you know, coins had lost more than 50% of their silver content by the time Locke is writing. And Locke thinks, as many others did as well, that this was, you know, a serious problem of legitimacy and stability, that somehow the kind of the state of the coin had been degraded to such an extent that something had to happen. But he didn't advocate aligning it with the market price. Instead, he wanted to collect all these coins in, melt them down, and recoin them at the old Elizabethan rate, restoring in some way the political promise that had been embodied on the coins. And I think that emphasizes nicely. And then, sorry, I should continue. Secondly, once you have done that, subsequent governments should not be allowed to tamper with it. Right? So you restore it to the previous rate. And then you associate with a stricture of, in some way, depoliticization. And what you end up with is a politics of depoliticization. It's a highly conscious move of tying money to fiat, but in order to remove it from subsequent politicking, rather than, you know, reintegrating it. Yeah.
Right. I wonder if it's, is the form of argument something like a, you know, a form of rational or ideal consent theory? That is that, you know, a community of people would, out of a kind of rational consent to a certain kind of ideal standard of money, and would not have consented to the, you know, degradation of the money as it degraded after the Elizabethan time period. So, and moreover, a group of rationally compacting individuals would not agree to a kind of arbitrary transformation of the standard of money by any government over time. You know, a rational community would only agree to a kind of a set standard. Now, the interesting thing that you emphasize is that set standard is itself super arbitrary, right? Yeah. So it's not clear why a rational community would.
Plus,
exactly,
the recoinage, yeah, as Locke advocated, or at least as it turned out, there's some debate about how closely it actually ended up following Locke's counsel. But what actually happening was clearly not at the interest of most people living, because it had a hugely disruptive effect that contracted the monetary supply, you know, created enormous economic problems, and arguably, you know, very ironically contributed to the birth of modern credit as we know it, rather than some restoration of an old Elizabethan standard. So if you're actually interested in the kind of consent of those living at the time, it's not at all clear that that's what you would end up with. Instead, I think what structured it is, you know, an argument about promising and oath-keeping, and the stability of, in particular, the post-revolutionary government and all its turmoil being closely tied to being seen to be able to keep promises, right? And so that restoration of the fiat isn't, I think, tied to a kind of ongoing conception of rational consent as much as it is to, you know, the almost holy aspect of promising itself. And the way in which violating that promise, being seen to have to go back on a previous promise, really endangers trust, not just in money, but in kind of the structures of the post-revolutionary government at large.
Yeah, this it seems to prefigure a little bit when you talk about Keynes and the constitutional order of money. It seems to like a little bit prefigure that. I mean, because another form of the argument you might say is something like this, that, you know, for Locke, you know, a community would rationally consent to a kind of constitutional order of money, maybe not, you know, a written constitution, but some implicit one that binds long generations of government that government can't just go back on.
I think is the politics of depolitization if not constitutionalism?
Right. Right.
Absolutely, yeah. I think Keynes was very conscious of this, and, you know, like many subsequent thinkers after Locke, consciously engaged Locke on precisely this point. And he made two critiques in that Lockean language and criticizing the Lockeans of his day in some way for having misunderstood Locke. So first of all, he criticized the way in which subsequent Lockeans of the kind of sound money tradition had in some way bought into the naturalization, had forgotten that this was a constitutional argument in the first place. You know, so it was an argument for stabilizing a fragile political order rather than an ontological argument about, you know, the nature of money or the nature of value. And as a result, they refused to engage in political argument and instead made kind of fundamental claims about, you know, the origins of value. And then secondly, he pointed out, and this is probably more a critique of Locke himself rather than the Lockeans, that in Locke's own frame, there is no possibility for revising the Constitution. There's no possible way to amend it. So once you have restored that promise, you cannot address any, you know, implications of it that you might want to address. It doesn't entail any mechanisms for constitutional amendment, so to speak. So this is the context in which Keynes famously uttered that, you know, the people who insist on the fulfillment of contracts, of promises, at all costs, they are the real fathers of the revolution. They have misunderstood the history of liberalism and endanger stability. Instead, if you really care about stability, you want to have ways to insist on contracts in the right circumstances, but also to be able to amend contracts and constitutions that are beginning to undermine stability rather than fulfilling it. But he's exactly engaging with him on that point.
Yeah, I wonder, I mean, it seems to me in some ways that Keynes is like the hero of your book in the sense that, tell me if I'm wrong about this, but
you're not the first one to say this. Yeah.
Oh, okay. But in the sense that you've sketched, and we'll talk about Fichte and Marx in a second, but you've sketched the sort of the pendulum swing between politicization and depoliticization over time. And, you know, Keynes represents a kind of middle ground. I mean, a way to balance the sort of liberal impulse of depoliticizing money with a democratic impulse to subject it to the political will. So I insist at some point that
this is not a book of heroes and villains. And nonetheless, you know, several readers, yourself included, have pointed out that Keynes seems to look awfully a lot like a hero in this tale. And I understand why. And it's definitely true that Keynes helped me to structure many of the kind of framings. And nonetheless, I would insist that that's not a heroic role. So instead, I would present him as a certain guide who helped me through that terrain. In various different forms in the different chapters. And I think that means that I think there is a way in which he was able to hold more than one view in mind and was able, I wouldn't say like a middle ground, but in some way he almost committed to both sides of an argument simultaneously and was somehow able to hold that tension in mind, like both sides of the ambivalent part of Aristotle's argument, for example. Keynes, you know, was often seen as trying to reviving the kind of capitalist engine in the 1930s with the general theory, and simultaneously wrote essays in which he described the love of money as a kind of, you know, a morbid, semi-pathological, you know, semi-criminal, form of pathology that had to be overcome eventually. So you see him holding onto both these sides. Simultaneously, I think he appreciates both the politics part of the politics of depoliticization and the depoliticization part. unlike, you know, very few others. So he's convinced, you know, as we just discussed, that Locke's solution lacks a political safety valve, that it actually creates a system that becomes naturalizing over time, like the gold standard, that cannot itself address its own repercussions, even as they completely go out of control, and becomes instead a catalyst of imbalance and, in the end, strife. And at the same time, he doesn't give up on the idea of a kind of Lockean form of depoliticization. He just thinks it has to be smarter, it has to be better, it has to be one that includes safety valves, that allows for ways to revise a settlement. But the point, in some way, is about removing economic questions from politics, at least temporarily, at least, you know, in certain contexts. And so his thinking here really tries to, you know, have the cake and eat it too, to kind of hold on to both of these ideas. And yet, I don't see him as a hero in this, because I want to insist on deviating from him frequently. I think there are many ways in which, you know, his perceptive analysis gets us like a really long way, and yet we might want to, you know, deviate from him when it comes to the way, for example, which we think about the democratization of institutions of monetary policy making in the end, which is very, very skeptical about. And so, like a guide, I trust him for most of the time, but I don't have to accept every single counsel. You know, I can very happily form my own opinion, take the guide's opinion into account, and decide to pursue a slightly different path. That's also why the book doesn't end with Keynes. You know, it, as much as I think that he got a lot right, and that, you know, clearly his world would be infinitely better than the world we live in today, it still comes with a lot of problems.
Rolling back the clock, back to Fichte, who offers quite a different account. So this is yet another alternative. Yep. I mean, also developing a social contract theory accounts, but one that's a, you know, a, you could say, a political contract around money rather than a pre-political contract around money is in Locke. You know, Fichte's Foundation's Natural Right, and then in the Closed Commercial State of 1800 is, you know, he has some pretty wild stuff. I'm working on Fichte now, so I could been reading through this
it's
material.
It's a lot of fun teaching him.
Oh, is that right? I haven't tried it. Oh, okay. I'd be interested in your experience, but yeah, so maybe you could kind of talk through Fichte's approach. I mean, in thinking, you know, how exactly, what are the ramifications of putting money into the part of the social contract rather than prior to it?
I mean, I should say, first of all, that I benefited enormously from talking to Isaac Nakamovsky, who wrote, you know, this seminal book that really put the Closed Commercial State back onto people's radar. And I certainly wouldn't have been able to write that chapter without Isaac's work. And at the same time, I was interested in embedding Fichte, not just in the kind of Rousseauian, like 18th century account, but also linking him back to Locke. I think there's a deep, deep engagement with Locke on questions of, you know, the monetary contract, but also questions of property. In some way, so much of what Fichte is doing there is trying to have his fun with coming up with a conception of property that turns out to entail a right to work. You know, so he's having fun with chapter five in some way again. But then also embedding him in the kind of monetary experiments that were happening at the time, not just in France, but in particular across the Channel. So the British suspension period, in which the British Empire, you know, really suspends gold in 1797 for, you know, almost two decades, and you know, experiments with fiat money, coincides precisely with Fichte, like several other German romantics, becoming very interested in the politics of fiat money. Now, that's a little different from the kind of much more sobering history of the French assignat, which had kind of gone up in flames earlier that year in 1797. Like, the British experiment shows you a very different way of, in some way, closing the loop completely, making it a perfectly circular thing where there's no connection to land anymore. Instead, money becomes tied to the kind of promise of the state. And like, the state becomes, in turn, some of, you could say, temporalized, as Pocock would have put it, in this larger scheme of public credit, in which a kind of a longer future suddenly dictates your horizon. And so I think Fichte is reworking the social contract tradition, is reworking Locke's argument with that in mind. And that means for him that money becomes one way in which you can kind of close the social contract. So just as the social contract would abolish, you know, in some way, anarchy in legal matters and replace it with reason and the rational state, you know, there is a problem still of how to do this in the realm of political economy, how to move from, you know, a system of anarchy and individual wills that could at best be synchronized with some kind of concept of the invisible hand, but without intentionality, without the kind of rationality that Fichte attributes to the rational state, but instead impose a way in which the rational state is actually able to guarantee the value of money. And so it's a very neat counterpicture to the Lockean argument, one that was intended to shock his audiences. And I think it still does today, because it's tied to the argument for complete closure of that state. So an argument for the abolition of the gold standard, the introduction of a pure fiat money standard, and an external closure of the state, all like within, you know, 100 plus pages. But what I think it nonetheless, actually, if you read closely, carries with it is a contemporary resonance that makes it look less like a kind of very silly, foolish, like late 18th century essay, but a kind of quite prescient way about the way in which, you know, the state in the form of central banks could actually have the task of stabilizing the value of money, right? Like, rather than the value of money being something that, you know, a gold standard, something externally is supposed to set in a way that you explicitly abandon control over, to the point, as Fichte points out, that very often it doesn't lead to stability, but you kind of tied yourself to a mast that ends up moving massively in one way or another. He thinks like a rational state should pursue the stable value of money. And again, this ties us back to Locke. He thinks that's a problem of constitutional law. Like, you know, it's like he says, like, very likely that most people will doubt that the state will be able to do this. But in some way, that's a problem of how do you design a constitution that ensures that the state acts in the interest of those it's meant to govern. And to kind of simply give up on that entire exercise, he thinks, you know, it's just in some way giving up the entire pursuit of a rational state and a social contract, of trying to align the way in which a state acts with the interests of its subjects.
Well, right. I mean, you're essentially, if you abandon that project of the closure of the commercial state, you're essentially subjecting the welfare of your people to the arbitrary whims of global capitalism, right? I mean, I take it that's
how empires.
Empires, particularly.
There's a long discussion in the preface of empires. Very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this will never be implemented because of that. He's like right. No empire will ever give up. But it has this amazing effect, and he's having a lot of fun with this by pointing out that, you know, far from fiat money, he doesn't want to have paper money. He thinks paper is people are too prejudiced about paper after the assignat. So it has to be some unknown material, very cheap to produce, impossible to forge. And because it will have to be a state secret, he unfortunately can't tell you what it will be. It's pretty convenient. But he has fun explaining to people that rather than this being arbitrary, whereas gold and silver have this like inherent stability, he thinks it's exactly the other way around. He thinks, like, you know, the value of gold and silver is essentially set by, you know, global public opinion. He says, like, it's not grounded in reason whatsoever. It's fickle. It moves for all kind of reasons that have nothing to do with what we, you know, consider to be important. And you want to tie yourself to that. That's arbitrary. You know, having a currency that the state is intending to control the value of, you know, that's not arbitrary. That's actually what it means to exercise, you know, reasonable self-governance. And so he has fun flipping this around. He's like, oh, if the history of money had been different, people would say, oh, why do you want me this? Give me this, you know, piece of gold for my good piece of paper here. You know, I'm not going to trade my piece of paper for your little lump of gold and so on. So it's all about arbitrariness versus rationality, if you so want.
Yeah, good. So switching over to Marx then. So why doesn't Marx accept something like a Fichtean solution? I mean, what, you know, Fichte is a, you know, kind of an interesting mix of a kind of liberal and a socialist. You know, Marx I take it the contribution of Marx in your story is as a kind of skeptic about the kinds of solutions that we've been talking about. Why not? What are the kind of limitations of these approaches?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the Fichtean proposal, although it's obviously kind of going nowhere, like the moment in some way it's written, already for Fichte it's clear there is no chance of ever being implemented. And the world as it changes, you know, only affirms this, kind of Britain returns to gold. Hegel writing the philosophy of right the same year as Britain returns in some way affirms, you know, this is the way in which states will be governed on the basis of Scottish political economy, not Fichte's closed commercial state. So it seems to be completely condemned by the court of world history. And yet, in particular in France, I think there is a literature partially drawing on Fichte, partially drawing on other sources that comes to appreciate the potential powers of monetary and credit reform, of imposing rationality on a gold standard system that seems to be irrational and in some way exploitative. So there's a huge tradition in France of the first half of the 19th century, a largely socialist tradition about monetary reform and the way in which it can lead the way out of exploitation. Proudhon is one famous proponent of this, but there are many, many others. And I think Marx initially starts out quite sympathetic to this, or at least he kind of, you know, he appreciates some fellow travelers of thinking about political economy critically. It's famously Proudhon who kind of first gets him interested in political economy and inspires him. And then very, very quickly, he kind of grows suspicious and falls out with that project. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that from, you know, the late 1840s all the way to Capital Volume 1, the animating strain is to articulate different, better critiques of why these various socialist proposals for monetary reform are short-sighted and fail to understand the nature of the problem. So that's where a lot of his animus comes from his first book against Proudhon, from his notes on various crises of the 1850s, to the shift towards a kind of more formal conception of value. One target is always the kind of hope, the socialist hope, particularly by French utopian socialists, that in changing the monetary system, you could actually change the economic system.
So it leaves us what? I mean, with overthrowing money, I take it as a kind of ultimate conclusion, right, on Marx's view. I mean, is there anything else other, you know, sort of positive to be said about his
contribution? Well, there's a big debate about whether on Marx's view, you end up with a kind of abolition of money, or with a kind of transformation of money that it's basically no money that no longer functions as capital. And part of this has to do with, like, you know, we know awfully little about Marx's thoughts on communism. We know a lot more what he thought about capitalism than what we know about communism, right? And I think the few fragments that we have come under even more scrutiny over the last 10 years as people have kind of picked through the manuscript and dismantled 20th century, not quite forgeries, but kind of assemblies of fragments that made it look like much more coherent text-like than this actually is. So we know a lot more about his critique than we know about what would actually come afterwards. In terms of the critique, I think most fundamentally he thought that there were dynamics of crises and exploitation inherent in what he called the capitalist value form, that any socialist attempt to simply change the monetary system but leave the system of production unchanged, which is simply missed, would be an epiphenomenal act that would just fail to get to the root of what was really going on. And similarly, on the kind of more liberal side, he thought that liberal legislative activities, like were happening in Britain during the 1840s, 50s, and 60s, to in some way, you know, regulate the monetary system better, to, you know, come up with better regulation of banks in order to prevent future crises, fail to understand that these crises were not rooted simply in the monetary system itself or the way in which banks were operating, but were rooted again in the way in which the kind of structures of production were operating under capitalism. And so it's this kind of two-sided critique of both socialists who had you know, very high hopes for monetary reform, and liberals who similarly had high forms for stabilizing capitalism. Marx thinks both of these accounts miss really the kind of inherent nature and instability of the system.
Good. Yeah. So we're just about out of time. I wanted to kind of take us up to the present and ask you about, in your epilogue, you talk about the financial crisis of 2008 and government fiscal policies in the wake of COVID. I was wondering if maybe you could speak to what it is about, you know, this history that you've sketched and these theorists that we've discussed that can shed light on, you know, government activity in those periods and the kinds of debates that we've had.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to stress is that the epilogue is not some conclusion of the historical analysis, that the historical accounts tell us what to do. If anything, it's meant to have a kind of liberatory effect of, you know, freeing us from some of these narratives that have removed money from the realm of political theory, political thought, constitutional analysis, and instead to give us the confidence that actually we have, you know, more than enough tools to discuss the politics of money from the perspective of political theory. But that doesn't mean that the historical figures straightforwardly tell us what to do. It really is on us. And I adopt a very different voice in the epilogue. It's not just simply a neo-Aristotelian account, or not even a kind of neo-Keynesian account. But instead, my starting point is some way to grapple with the stranglehold we find ourselves in since the financial crises, of having two aha effects that nonetheless haven't liberated us. On the one hand, we've recognized that the state is much more involved in the financial system, right? That actually, not just through bailouts in the moment of crises, but in its ongoing support of the banking system, finance really isn't separate from the state. Banks aren't just simply private corporation like a supermarket, but they are part of a hybrid system. Our monetary system is a hybrid public-private system. And then the second aha effect is that this hasn't quite allowed us to do what we want to do, but that, you know, we continue to be utterly dependent on the private part in this hybrid, not least because monetary policy transmission largely functions through the way in which banks decide to pass on changes in interest rates, partially because any kind of uncertainty in the realm of finance immediately kills, you know, the entire investment landscape. So there's a whole set of ways in which we continue to be dependent. One might even be, you know, saying blackmail to some extent by a financial system that is integrated with the state and nonetheless seems to be pursuing its own interest. I think that in some way validates and frustrates many of the characters of my tale. So in some way it grants a lot of influence to Marx's more skeptical account, that pointing out that something is socially constructed doesn't mean that you can simply, you know, mold it in your own interest, that you can simply, you know, shape the monetary system like you would prefer and it's going to achieve the ends that you would like it to do. Our system is a hybrid one without that possibility. And yet, it seems premature to simply give up on the scope for exploring the ways in which the financial system depends on politics, on the state, and ultimately democratic decision-making. And to find kind of chinks in the armor, to find moments of strategic weakness, to begin to think more democratically about that system. Now, so that's the kind of agonizing position that I find myself in, of wanting to encourage us to do more about this, but often sharing Marx's skepticism that, you know, most of the most straightforward ways of doing this are forestalled for obvious reasons.
All right. It sounds to me like we're in a kind of Lockean moment on your view. That is a, you know, a moment in which there's a kind of set of forces that are outside of democratic control. I think about the Fed, you know, raising interest rates and whatnot. It seems like this kind of structure that's outside of politics that just does this stuff in relation to some kind of natural set of forces. So in the case, I mean, just to take that kind of example, I mean, would it be better on, I don't know, pick any of these theorists' views if, say, you know, before the Fed raises interest rates, it comes up for a legislative vote or for a referendum or citizen jury or I don't know, something like that. I mean, would that be a promising path forward to move to that?
I mean, in some way, this is the last fully functioning part of the American state, right? Like the fact that it's so isolated from other bodies of democratic decision making, you know, has allowed the Fed to actually, you know, in some way stabilize the global economic system as much as it has. And it's doing so in a very sophisticated way. And I don't think one should easily dismiss that. I also think that many of the existing, you know, democratic institutions that, you know, one could connect to the Fed, you know, probably introduce more problems than solutions, right? So I'm very hesitant with that. And yet, I share the opinion of those who think that by removing questions of monetary policy so systematically from democratic decision making, we actually arguably undermine in a really profound way our conception of kind of democratic self-government in the long run. These are decisions that are more and more significant in all our lives. You know, and they only continue to become more important, not just in the US, but even globally, right? The decisions of the Fed have just enormous repercussions around the world. And to insulate those from any ability on our part to shape those decisions, I think really risks, first of all, you know, in the long run, producing decisions that are maybe not exactly what are in the interest of most, but rather in the interest of those who kind of manage this hybrid system. Think of the ways in which bailouts are operating. It's not clear that it's always the kind of, you know, public interest in a broad sense that dictates this, but rather concerns of financial stability and liquidity for existing players. But also I worry that it actually hollows out kind of democratic self-conceptions more broadly. That if like the one area of our lives that seems to be governing so many others and has such an overburdening effect on the way in which we live is excluded from democratic decision-making, surely is something we should be worrying about. And yet, I don't think there's any easy way to just simply, you know, democratize it, to kind of easily, you know, reintegrate the Fed into Congress and we're going to have great, you know, decision-making on the monetary policy level. Obviously, that would be silly. So instead, I think it's on us to think much more creatively about ways in which we can like integrate on an institutional level, you know, forms of democratic decision making in these, you know, very complex institutions. And that can be by, you know, broadening the way in which they make decisions internally. But it also can mean, you know, introducing new forms of accountability. But we can't give up on it, you know, and yet we need to develop new tools for addressing it, because I think none of the tools that we currently have a plausible claim to be an easy fix for this.
Well, Stefan, this has been a great conversation. Let me thank you once again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.